Hour one of the Dr. Future Show straight ahead.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Okay, happy Future Tuesday, everyone. Welcome to another wonderful week in beautiful downtown Santa Cruz. Hey, we're not actually downtown, but, you know, we're by the...
By the lovely lagoon. Yeah. The giant towers with the flashing red lights. You can always find us.
Yes. Nicer than Burbank or something like that.
It's hard to beat Santa Cruz, that's for sure.
And so I hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. We sure did. We both had a family gathering with Mrs. Future's family.
Family and friends.
We went out to Middleton, where Harbin Hot Springs used to be. No longer. It burnt down last year in the big fires, but there's still a community there of wonderful people that we know, many of whom used to live in the Santa Cruz area. So shout out to them and to a wonderful gathering of friends in that part of the world. This week, we have, on the second hour, we have Captain Crunch planning to come in. John Draper, Captain Crunch, is known for being one of the first big hackers in the United States, and he's going to help us identify what apps and such to use for having private communications in this day of the NSA technologies that are so prevalent. How can we have such thing as privacy? And he's going to help us focus on that. That should be interesting. Meanwhile, we do have some stories we're going to cover in this series, Dr. Future Stories, that will bring you into our world. Not the least of which is this way cool NASA piece on NASA snaps some stunning new photos of the dwarf planet Ceres. Hey, MZ stops by. All right.
There you go. Yay. We're talking about the planet, and Michael shows up in close Earth orbit here.
Yeah.
Okay. And planning a little walk a little later in the day. Sounds good.
All right. So NASA's Dawn probe is snapping some stunning new views of the dwarf planet Ceres. Now, in case you don't remember or need to know, Ceres is in the asteroid belt. And it's a very interesting little planetoid because it has more water on it than the Earth, right? You know, we all talk about this being a water planet. Well, yes, but there are other places to find water in the solar system. And Ceres is one of them. Now, we are getting some nice close-up pictures of it. And we're very curious about it because it had these two super bright spots on it. You remember that in one of the craters?
Yeah. Some of the most noteworthy things about Ceres is the bright spots. They're quite a mystery. It looks like two of them from far away, but there's actually quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting some close-ups. We have a link on our drfutureshow.com/links page where you can take a closer look at those. There's a crater on Ceres that's 57 miles wide, 57 miles wide, 2.5 miles deep. That's about 77 times larger than the Barringer crater in Arizona, which is quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And Don took the picture when it was about 920 miles above the surface in early October.
Mm-hmm.
So planetary scientists think the bright spots might be from some briny material bubbling up during geological activity at this point, some kind of salt shining through.
Shiny crystal salt.
Yeah.
On our little dwarf planet.
As the liquid bubbles up, it would sublimate away and leave salts behind. So that's one of the top theories, right, on why we have these bright spots. Another theory is that an asteroid slammed into Ceres and caused an upwelling, which may have caused the original crater to begin with. Anyway, interesting. Dawn's new orbit will be about 4,500 miles from Ceres, and NASA is sending the probe to higher altitudes where it can make additional measurements. So we'll be able to look for information about cosmic rays that are in that area and compare them to readings closer in the solar system. Because, you know, cosmic rays and radiation are some of the big concerns about moving humans into space, as we can get rather ill from the wrong kind of rays going through our bodies.
Yes. A lot of people who question our actual space history say that's the main thing that they're worried about, is that we haven't actually succeeded in getting past some of the radiation issues as we exit the planet.
Yeah, that makes it much safer for robots than it does for humans, sadly enough. The other interesting space news here is, you know, we got President-elect Donald Trump in, and people have been wondering what his attitude is towards NASA. And NASA folks are kind of hoping that he'll look the other way and leave them alone for 4 years. But that's probably not going to happen. That's probably not going to happen. Look at this. My phone, my computer's going crazy already here.
Really? Your computer's speaking up, so yeah. You don't have to, huh?
Yeah,
should
right,
we plug
right.
it in no, so the audience can see?
I got it.
Has it got a mind of its own? What happened?
You know how you go to web pages and they just start playing things, like ads
yes.
on them?
It's yes. annoying, right? All you web designers out there, stop being annoying. Yeah. Don't do it.
So back to Trump and NASA. The main thing is that most people think he's going to want NASA to focus on space stuff. Like, let's go to Mars. Let's do that. But stay away from the Earth. Stop focusing on weather stuff.
Who is expecting that? The NASA scientists?
Yeah.
Or
well, that's where they're
the
beginning
Trump
to
watchers,
sense.
The Trump watchers? Or who's your source?
This is by Brian Eng from Headlines and Global News. HNGN is my source for this.
Okay.
Trump believes that the Space Administration is better off, you know, pursuing the bigger picture beyond Earth. So instead of spending money on planets' weather forecasts, it'll be appropriate if financing is tied up to the deep end of the frontier, which is Mars, etc.
That's one way of looking at it, but it makes sense that you would get the best information about the planet from space. So why not let the space agency look at the Earth?
I think they will. It's just going to be a different department than NASA. Some department that looks at the weather patterns on their planet would be, is it NOAA? NOAA, I think, focuses on that. Bob Walker, the upcoming president's advisor on space policy, shares that NASA has been merely functioning as a management center for sustaining needed resources in space. And the group has been dragged into this political approach of environmental programs, not because they would necessarily want to, but because there's been an environmental focus on the Earth of under the Obama administration.
So let's see. Let me decode what you're saying. You're saying that the NASA folks want to do deep space study. They're tired of doing weather forecasting on Earth.
They're not tired. They've been
dragged into it because that's how they're getting their budget. Or somebody wants to spend their budget that way.
There's been more money for the environmental focus than the deep space stuff.
Right.
So that might get changed around a little bit. Which is interesting.
We should really go to our break, you know.
Okay, let's do that. Then.
All right, folks, Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking Dr. Future news. Prior to current developments, NASA has been on the hot seat due to its overblown funding. And this year, NASA was granted a 30% increase in its budget that amounted to about $2 billion. And although the current presidency planned to cut the flow of support by $840 million next year, NASA's overall monetary resources have increased by 50% under the Obama administration. But still, $2 billion being 30% of your budget, that's, Brother Norm here pointed out that that's the paperclip budget for the Pentagon. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, well, they certainly do earn their lunch.
So we are kind of fighting over the crumbs here in terms of the budget for things. Part of NASA's spending spree has been focused on science projects like the Cyclone Global Navigation Satellite System. And you might ask what that does.
What does that do?
It monitors the ocean's surface wind speed through an 8-satellite setup.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at ocean surface wind speeds.
That's pretty important for predicting the jet stream and for monitoring global warming, et cetera, right? That's the main thing that they're looking for?
Well, Thomas Zurbuch, the space agency's science administrator, has defended the venture. He declares that NASA's Earth science function is essential to human life on the planet. However, Republicans have criticized this as being an expensive approach to weather assessment.
Well, when it comes to scientific research, I really applaud the generalists in the world who try and bring together lots of different environments and lots of different disciplines, because I think there's a lot to learn when your knowledge is not narrowly focused.
Yeah. Well, what some are speculating, as of late, it's being anticipated that the Trump administration will pursue a return to the moon. We haven't been to the moon since 1972.
You know, it's really funny how when we're talking about news with Donald Trump, it has the pattern of if you just say his name, then suddenly you're newsworthy. It's almost like the way that the Trump name is on top of all of the things that he's built, all of his buildings, all of his brands. Now it's all of the news that if you can just work in something that says Trump, then all of a sudden whoever's saying it doesn't matter. Suddenly it's important.
Well, yes, like MSG mentioned in previous shows. But still, it's an important time because it is a transition time when the new administration is coming in and they're going to affect everything that has to do with government spending. So NASA being an important component of it and part of our watch as the Dr. Future show.
Yes. Well, I'm very curious to see what happens, but I'm expecting the unexpected. I think anybody who's prognosticating about what to expect is really just blowing wind.
Yeah, chances are. Nonetheless, the pundits are saying, expect to focus not so much on the Earth and more on Mars and the Moon for exploration.
Oh. You know, our house guest this morning gave me a very funny perspective on that, that the reason why we want to focus on the planet Mars is because nobody owns it yet, and it'd be the perfect place to put a giant Trump crater. Or a giant Trump Martian module, a new colony, to be the president who's sitting in office while the first people land on Mars. That would be very Trump-worthy, don't you think?
And you could build a giant effigy in one of the cliffs there that makes anything on this planet look small.
Oh, you mean like Mount Rushmore on Mars could have Trump's face on it?
Well, you've heard the face on Mars.
Maybe
Hoagland's face on Mars.
It really recontextualizes the face on Mars.
But you could make one, right? And that would, and you could see it from the Earth.
Talk about terraforming.
Yeah, now there's advertising for you, or
wow,
whatever you want to call it.
The new Trump Tower on top of the largest volcano in the solar system, right? Isn't the Martian volcano?
Oh, it's like three times bigger than anything on Earth.
And anything on any other solid planet, right? We don't know about the gaseous planets, but on the solid planets, we haven't found a bigger volcano.
No. Now, we can carve stuff on the surface that we can see from Earth. It's really good. You can do that on the Moon, too.
I think this would definitely energize the Trump administration. Well, I could see him getting behind this.
If Coke could put their insignia on the Moon, maybe they'd pay for it all. Then everyone have to look at it every night.
The Coke in the Moon.
Oh, yeah, I'm telling
it really
you.
Really changes our global myth.
If you think commercially. Silly idea,
These
I know.
These are great ideas.
You think?
Yes, oh, we have a caller who'd like to chime in, I believe.
Okay.
Hello, David. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Hi, howdy. Yeah, greetings from San Francisco.
Hey, greetings.
Not too long ago, I was studying Dick Cheney because I'm just that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I ran into some news stories from 2006. These were the spring of 2006, and they were financial newspapers that were claiming that Dick Cheney had invested in the collapse of America. And so basically, he was putting his money into bond funds in Europe. Mm-hmm. That were anticipating the economic crash that happened in 2007, 2008.
Where does the smart money go?
Well, that's exactly right. So when you start looking at the way that Trump is making his investments, he's basically, or his appointments, he's investing in people who are basically criminals, who are, like, I was listening to a show earlier today, and the person that's invested in Health and Human Services, or he's trying
Price?
To appoint.
The new, his name is Price.
Right.
The Price is right for Health and Human Services to be abolished.
Well, that's
He's
exactly
from Georgia, right?
Right?
I'm imagining that, you know, he's probably learned a lot from the prison system. I think Georgia is very famous for their prison system.
Sure.
No, but he's an orthopedic surgeon.
He comes from a family of physicians, and you would think that he would have read the Hippocratic Oath, which talks about first do no harm, and then the idea that the original Hippocratic Oath said that a doctor was supposed to heal first and deal with money later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at the way that this guy Price's take on Medicaid, Medicare, all of these other, whether it's Obamacare or anything else, he wants to deal with money first and healing later. So when you start looking in history, the reason why Hippocrates came up with this was because of insane kings who basically didn't treat the population. And when they got an epidemic, the whole town or the whole kingdom was decimated because they were so stingy that they demanded money before they healed people.
Wow.
And when you start looking at, and in fact, don't you remember Edgar Allan Poe did his famous story, The Mask of the Red Death. And it was the idea that a king had an epidemic outside his castle walls, and he just slammed the door, didn't send any doctors out there, just had a party inside and pretended that nothing else was, or nothing was going on. So you look at these guys, they are disinvesting in America. Mm-hmm. It's as if not only are they trying to, they're either totally insane and they don't think that an epidemic is going to reach them, or they are trying to kill us.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do? Let's just assume that's true. Let's just assume this is the problem with the unfeeling, lacking in empathy leaders that we've had for a very long time, and this just being the latest crop. If the Trump administration was just a normal Republican administration, we'd just be fighting over how to downsize the government and make people more independent and more free. But we're not fighting about that. We're talking about how to basically rip the guts out of the liberal progress that's been made and put people on their own feet, but not guarantee them a minimum wage. We're kind of like shooting from above and shooting from below. So what are we supposed to do?
There's no wisdom to any of it. It's all just, and in fact, when you start looking at his other appointments, he wanted to put Jamie Dimon, one of the worst of the bank, you know, the corrupt bank people from the 2008 crash. Jamie Dimon, he was the CEO of J.P. Morgan. He wants to put him as the head of the Treasury.
Would you like to hang on during the break? We've got to go to CBS News right now.
Thanks.
All right, Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Okay, we're back on the Dr. Future Show. I just got a hi from J.D. Crunchman to Captain Crunch for the second hour of the show. We'll be talking about privacy and how you can secure it. And we have a caller on the line.
We do. We're still speaking with David from San Francisco, and he has a few things to say about our prospects under the next administration, I'd say. Is that a reasonable intro for you there, David?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because you remember years and years ago, there was the book, The Power of Positive Thinking.
Sure.
Yeah, I think and grow
I
rich
live
too.
That way.
Yeah. Well, if you ever read the intro to that book, I think that was Norman Vincent Peale wrote that book, mm-hmm. and he was a religious guy, and he read this old passage in the Old Testament, if I remember right. It might even have been somewhere around the Garden of Eden, and it was that every one of God's worst fears came to pass. And so Norman Vincent Peale read that, and he said, well, maybe we should have the power of positive thinking. And so the idea that all of man, after they fell out of Garden of Eden, they started getting into all kinds of trouble. So when you start looking at the aftermath of Trump, I'm not interested in making things worse. The neocons, have you all read any of the Exxon files?
No, I haven't seen those, but I just want to make one statement about the power of positive thinking. These days, we seem to be going towards the paradigm from where we derived our positive and negative thoughts. That's why we have the non-dual conferences in San Francisco now. So there's a state of mind from which positive and negative emerge, and that state is really where you're at cause, so you're coming from a creative place in universe.
And you could say that Trump lives in that state of non-dualism, because I see him as the kind of executive who's just sitting on the fence, and he's going to let the experts that he brings in duke it out, and then he's going to put his thumb on the scale when it makes sense to him that it's profitable, it's his version of morality, it's good for business the way that he defines it, you know. But he definitely has not decided ahead of time where he's going to throw his weight. That's the kind of executive that he strikes me as.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because when he was young, basically, I guess, a teenager in the 60s, you remember after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, there became the white flight. and all of the white people in the major cities of America ran to the suburbs and left their houses behind in the cities. And so all the major cities in America, whether it was New York City, I'm from St. Louis, Detroit, whatnot, became huge suburbs, and the cities became kind of ghost towns. And
yeah, they call them donut cities now, right? Because they're kind of like empty in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you start looking at Donald Trump's fortune, he cashed in on that. He bought up, as the whites were leaving town, Donald Trump started buying the land at $1 an acre. So he knows that he can cash in on despair. And he also knows that this inflation rate in New York has been to his advantage. So he's sitting right in the middle, where does he want more inflation or does he want the collapse so that he can get out there and buy it up at $1 an acre? Mm-hmm. And when you look at, if you've kept up with there was a corrupt Supreme Court ruling about 10 years ago called the Kelo decision. And the Kelo decision said that eminent domain could now be used for developers who could make better use of your land than you can. And it was based on the idea that tax revenues from land could be derived basically on a promise. You know, if a developer promised to get a whole bunch of tax revenues from your farm, you know, more than you're paying on agricultural rate, then the developer could take your land through eminent domain. Now imagine we've got a developer like Donald Trump that's never told a truth in his life, and he has the power of eminent domain all across America. I mean, this is...
Well, it is a democracy. Now, really, I'm really counting on the fact that in a democracy, one famous guy, even if he's in the president's seat, is not the only decision maker. And
well,
so
Kelo has a huge amount of override. For example, this pipeline that's going through North Dakota all the way down to Illinois, that's 1,800 miles, and they did what was called fast-tracking the permits. Now, I remember seeing a highway down in Atlanta that they had 4 miles of highway, and it took them 20 years to get through the permit process because each individual landowner didn't want to sell except for a better price. And how can they get 1,800 miles of pipeline within months? It's impossible unless they did it through Kelo and fast-tracking. So there are people, and that's why I brought up Dick Cheney in the beginning, that there are people that are intentionally disinvesting in America and going out of their way to cash in on the collapse of America so they can buy it up at auction when we're all despairing. And the reason why I also raised the idea of Trump's appointments, to me, are more like organized crime. He's either putting incompetence in there, or he's putting in people. If you know about foreclosures on houses, they usually happen because people have medical problems that are so expensive, they have to sell the family house. So when you start taking a guy and putting him in charge of Health and Human Services, he decimates the payout on medical plans. The people are forced to sell their houses at cheap. There goes America sold to Trump's buddies at $2 an acre.
Yeah, I think NBR pointed out. Yeah. It's like putting the fox in charge of the hen house.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the
Kelo decision is a horrible one. Both Republicans and Democrats, Libertarians, Greens, everybody hated the Kelo decision. Because if you're not familiar with it, eminent domain from 1776 to, you know, the early part of the 2000s was that your land could only be taken if it was going to be used for some public good. They had to be putting in a school or a library or a sewer system or a sidewalk or something that was to be the, you know, for public use. But then this Kelo decision said the tax base was the tipping point, that if a developer promised to get sales tax better than the sales tax revenues from a shopping mall was going to be better than some houses, then that was the public good. And that's total hokum.
Yeah, well, now what, though? I mean, you know, what can we do about this? It's what's happening, right?
Well, there are solutions. And,
yeah.
If you were to look at market forces,
yeah.
Honestly, I'm looking at an old expression called Jubilee. If you were playing a poker game and you realized somebody had stacked the deck, there's no way that you would keep chipping in. Well, at this point, since 2008, everybody knows the game's rigged. The banks never got prosecuted like Jamie Dimon. Not only is he not prosecuted, but they're now putting him up as Treasury Secretary. So that means that not only is a guy like a criminal from the 2008 collapse going to be the one that hauls in all of your tax revenues on April 15th, and he's going to be able to milk it and take advantage of it, there's no way that I should continue to use the U.S. dollar. And so the whole idea that the collapse of the U.S. economy is going to be based upon whether or not a guy like Donald Trump puts in enough organized crime figures that are going to be managing this country. And when we're coming on Valley Forge, the anniversary of Valley Forge, and if you know the history of that, Washington and the troops were freezing at Valley Forge because the British, they had counterfeited the Continental Dollar. And the Continental Dollar, it wasn't worth the Continental anymore. So Ben Franklin and them had to get out the printing press and come up with a new design. Well, that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to come up with a new design of money because the corrupt have scooped up as much as they could possibly hold. And then they're basically killing us at their pleasure. So,
that's a whole show in and of itself. We've been looking at major efforts going on in the Bay Area, especially for designing the ultimate cryptocurrency, for example, and how would that actually work? And we'll delve into that a little bit more. But in any event, appreciate your input on this. We do have a couple other stories we want to cover in this hour.
Until next time.
Yes, thanks so much for being part of the show,
David. Appreciate your call. Really good stuff to ponder. Okay. So we seem to have a bit of an echo on that channel,
echo. Well, it's probably his radio on.
Okay. So, yeah, sorry, folks. Please do call. I noticed that we had a few other callers who maybe just ran out of time. But when we have a good topic going like that, we got to keep going with it. So.
Yeah. Okay. And just to take you into a slightly different universe, Caltech scientists recently used bacterial protein to merge silicon and carbon and create a new organosilicon organism.
Now, my dear Dr. Future, can you please explain to me why this is so important?
Well, we're starting to breed new forms of life that are a combination of silicon and carbon. In its simpler form, before they're alive, when they're just compounds, they're used in several industries. Organosilicon compounds are found in pharmaceuticals, in agricultural chemicals and paints, in semiconductors, in computer and TV screens. And they're made synthetically using a technique called directed evolution. Directed evolution. It's a way of using evolutionary biological principles for creating compounds.
So, if I'm putting it together properly from the article, there was a discovery of a carbon-silicon bond in a remote lake, and there's a bunch of scientific research how nature created these extremophiles and naturally put together this carbon and silicon, but it has never been prevalent on the rest of the planet.
Except for our research. We're very clever monkeys. We figured out how to do directed evolution.
And this is what directed evolution is. We found it in nature. Now we're going to put our foot on the gas accelerator.
It's like breeding
faster.
It's like breeding a racehorse. Mm-hmm. A good breeder recognizes the inherent ability of a horse to become a racer and to bring that out in successive generation. Only they're doing that on the level of proteins.
Got it.
Right? It's a similar kind of approach.
Listen, let's go to a break and pick up where we left off when we come back. Is that going to work for you?
Perfect.
Okay. Dr. Future Show. Stay tuned.
Okay. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, we were just talking about how we're evolving silicon carbon life forms.
Yeah, I pulled up the table of elements to tell you some interesting things about carbon and silicon and what they have in common with each other.
Yes, and the study that we're talking about is the first to show that nature can adapt to incorporate silicon into carbon-based molecules, the building blocks of life itself. Because carbon and silicon are very similar chemically, and silicon is the second most abundant element in the Earth's crust.
Yeah, carbon and silicon on the periodic table are in the same vertical column, which means they have the same valence.
So they're ultimately very compatible for many chemical processes.
Yes.
They can both form bonds to four atoms simultaneously, so that makes them well-suited for long chains of molecules found in life, like proteins, for example, and DNA. And the sci-fi writers have imagined whole alien worlds with silicon-based life. Remember the Horta in the original Star Trek?
No. The Horta? What did they
The Horta were a rock life form. They looked like rocks, but they kind of moved. They're kind of like lava rocks.
And they had really nice sound effects.
They did. And I think it was Spock that did the mind meld to actually communicate with them.
Right.
Thank God for Vulcan mind melds.
Right. How do you speak to a rock? You just hold on to its shoulder.
However, keep in mind, this is evolving. We haven't really created a truly living organism that uses the silicon-carbon bonds together, even though silicon is very abundant and all around us, and the rocks and on the beach. But it is definitely a vector for the future. Other planets, Mars has both silicon and carbon. Asteroids, same thing. Could alien life have evolved silicon-carbon semiconductor brains?
Yeah, the thing that these two elements share is that they fall into a classification of elements which are called nonmetals. So they're very close to the metals, which of course are conductors, but they're considered nonmetals, and they're between the metals and the noble gases. So I guess for their electrical properties, they're ideally suited for life somehow.
And chemical processes, making all kinds of really, really interesting compounds. So keep an eye on that. It's called organosilicon compounds.
So the people in the nanomolecular world are very excited about that article. There was a whole slew of people reading the original research and responding to it.
Right. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And just to show that, you know, everything is not what it seems to be, a new study just came out this week where a number of scientists are challenging Einstein's theory on the speed of light.
Ooh, now we're going deep here. Boy, you just don't know what is going to stay solid under the next administration. We're going to challenge the speed of light?
That's right. A new proposed experiment to test Einstein's concept of the speed of light, traveling at a constant rate, could turn the theory of relativity on its head. It's a new study. A couple of scientists report they believe the speed of light was actually faster right when the Big Bang happened.
Mm-hmm. I see. So the problem with the speed of light isn't that we can't go faster. It's that it has slowed down.
Yes, speed of light has slowed down. If it's true, this would help a scientist explain why the universe's temperature has managed to even out so quickly after the Big Bang.
Okay, fill in some of the blanks for me here?
Well,
let me just give you an blur. Overview.
This would also call into question Einstein's basis in the theory of relativity. They'll be testing this theory to use readings from cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the map of the oldest light in the universe. We're looking at the oldest light. And remember, this is just a theory. Einstein himself had once said, quote, "No amount of experimentation can ever prove me right. A single experiment can prove me wrong."
So that's what they're after.
That's good.
The one experiment that can prove that everything we know is wrong. Our universe is not defined by the speed of light. In fact, light can go faster than that. We don't know how to prove it.
So like in science, as in politics or anything else, what are the stories that we believe to be true? For what we believe to be true is what we act on and what we expand our understanding from.
Well, I guess that's kind of a optimist point of view, that somehow we're not limited even by the speed of light.
That the speed of light itself wasn't constant. What it tells us is that many constants seem to be variables.
Well, what does it make you think in terms of the philosophical consequences?
Well, I think of it in the context of consciousness itself. You know, the consciousness is the silly putty, the mercury, the aspect of universe that we're using right now to communicate with each other. There's something about it and its speed and the way it relates to the physical universe, speed of light, matter, all that, that somehow creates the breakthrough to a true
So we're already, through consciousness, moving faster than the speed of light with communication.
Consciousness itself, probably aspects of consciousness itself actually do that.
Yeah. I see. So when we study, science just studies the slow stuff.
Well, they study the stuff that is more easily studied. Consciousness is very hard to study. I mean, our awareness is the most complicated thing in the universe as far as we can ascertain. Right.
Let's define science as the stuff that is slow enough for us to study, and we'll leave the unexplainable in the realm of anybody's guess.
To the psychologists. They're the ones that know it all. Did you know? Okay, never mind. On a pragmatic level, this is really down-to-earth stuff here, but it is really powerful because we use this stuff every day. A very interesting article in Kurzweil AI, online news magazine. Battery breakthrough charges in seconds, lasts for weeks. That's what we want. A battery that charges in second and lasts for a long period of time.
Well, when you say last, does it last while you're using it or it just stores it for a long time?
Well, when you use it, I'm sure it doesn't last as long.
That's because I'm just remembering that recently you got what we thought of was just a marvelous new battery technology, and it was a lithium-ion battery, and it fit in a very small container, something you could hold in your hand, and it was powerful enough to charge your car battery.
You could use it to recharge your car. Yes, lithium-ion batteries can charge car batteries.
They're
replacing the chargers you carry in the back of your trunk.
But the only thing it could do is that one first push, and then it was depleted. You couldn't keep using it the way that you can use a battery over time, right? You can do like one big burst.
It doesn't give as many bursts.
Right. So a battery that can be used is probably more important than a battery that can be charged quickly and that can store it for a long time. But as soon as you use it, you have to find more power. You have to
restore that battery again. The specs, of course, would be such that you'd be able to do big charges, outputs, as well as input. But this kind of fits the idea of a capacitor. You familiar with the concept of a capacitor?
Not really.
Tesla once described the Earth itself as a giant capacitor.
So explain to me how a capacitor works.
The main thing to remember about capacitors and supercapacitor designs is that they can take a charge all at once. I mean, imagine that you had something that could just absorb a lightning bolt.
So it's a sponge for lightning.
Yeah, just takes it like that. Uh-huh. And charges at that rate of speed at which you can feed it. So you would charge a capacitor in a pragmatic case with plugging it into the wall and getting some 110 volts into it.
So that definitely has its place in the efficiency of batteries. So you want it to be fast.
So the ideal supercapacitor would replace lithium batteries because it would allow you to charge a mobile phone in a few seconds, and then that charge would last up to a week. It would have enough of a oomph to last a week as opposed to a day. Right now, how long do you charge your cell phone every day?
The power goes in fast, and it still can trickle out slowly.
Right.
Okay.
And you want some good specs along those lines. Yeah, in this case, it's an easier spec to charge phones and such as opposed to the charges needed to start a car. Starting a car takes a huge amount of voltage. It's like a lot of amperage, as they say. So it's harder to do that. But then, thankfully, we don't need to do that as much as we need to charge our phones. Most of the time, our cars start just fine. You know, so that's the good news. So there's a new proof of concept design based on a hybrid supercapacitor. It has a core of millions of highly conductive little nanowires that are coated with shells of two-dimensional materials. And it combines that fast charging and discharging with a high power density and a high storage capacity.
Cool. So is this going to be helpful, say, in the electric car industry?
Oh, definitely. Electric cars will benefit from longer range of operation and sudden bursts of power and speed, which they need, you know, for acceleration, getting on and off freeway ramps. The material would also be a significant advancement in creating wearable tech, because you'd be able to have clothing designs.
You just plug your shirt in before you go out.
And heat.
Then you can have your little electronic show on your shirt.
Well, it could be jewelry, but
all night.
But if the power is cheap, then it can also heat you. You could just wear a t-shirt in the wintertime.
Oh, like your car seat heater.
Yeah.
Except it would be a shirt.
Electric blanket for your body.
That
kind of
really
stuff becomes
nice.
Possible. All kinds of designers will jump on that, I'm sure.
I'm sure. That sounds really fun.
It also avoids the risk of overheating and explosion, which we have with lithium ion batteries.
Right.
Kind of curious. Okay. Boy, that went fast, that hour.
Sure did.
Yeah.
I'm sure the next hour is going to fly by, too.
Yeah, we're going to see if we can get Captain Crunch on here to talk about what apps and such you should use if you want privacy in your communications.
Okay.
He's going to also bring us up to date on his world of the hacker universe.
So we're talking about Captain Crunch, the famous hacker. So stay tuned for hour number two of Dr. Future Show. This is the Dr. Future Show on KSEO Santa Cruz in Santa Cruz in the Bay Area.
We're in your head, actually.
All right, more to come.